Good evening, everybody. It's a very great pleasure to have Professor Ernst here tonight. We actually far too rarely have scientists speaking at LSE, and we very, very rarely have such a distinguished scientist as Professor Ernst, so that's in itself a great pleasure. In the scientific arena, where he worked most of his life, he's famous for his work on nuclear magnetic resonance, which was a technique which he improved till it could be used to determine the structure of molecules within the biological context. And then, of course, it led on to MRI in medicine. So really very, very important series of discoveries for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1991. I think most of this work was done at the ETH in Zurich. Now, more recently, he's been devoting his energies to the question of the social responsibilities of science, which is, of course, incredibly important, and that's what his lecture is mainly going to be about. He'll talk for something like 45 minutes, then we'll have a comment from the Swiss ambassador, and another comment from Hilary Steedman of the CEP, Centre for Economic Performance, here, and then we'll have a discussion. So, please welcome Professor Ernst.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lord Layard, for your kind introduction. It's indeed an enormous pleasure and an honor for me to open this Swiss Science Forum lecture series, which is organized by the Swiss ambassador, Bruno Spinner, together with Dr. Lutz-Peter Berg. And particularly to speak once here at the world famous London School of Economics and Political Science. What a challenge for a simple physical chemist to say more than he knows about the subject, well beyond his horizon. And you know, my horizon is just basic science. But you probably have heard this saying by one of the greatest scholars here at LSE, Karl Popper, who once said, "Perhaps I am wrong and you are right. Anyway, we both can hope after our discussion to see a little bit clearer." So I'm sure that at least at the end of today's lecture, you will better appreciate my own limitations, and I'm waiting then for the death verdict by Dr. Hilary Steedman at the end of my lecture. Now, we in Switzerland and you in the UK, we are all living on islands. You are living on a natural island here, encircled by oceans, and we in Switzerland on an artificial, self-inflicted one, surrounded by the European Union. And we are both suspected to suffer by our isolation. And you know, it makes particular fun to be different than anybody else. But we also have much in common in terms of academia, in economics, and also in politics. We have both a very strong university research system, high level of creativity, probably coming out of the fact that we are different or feel different than anybody else. In economic terms, we have a very strong global impact, of course, of different dimensions in Switzerland and England, but we also have both important financial centers, and in terms of politics, we are both proud of our historical democracy and our inborn desire for independence. And here again, Karl Popper has said essentially the same. It is interesting and remarkable that England and Switzerland, the two oldest democracies of present Europe, are today so similar in their love for freedom and their willingness to defend it. In many other respects and in their political origin, these two democracies are entirely different. And we are also entirely different regarding our views regarding the export of democracy by brute force. But that's anyway a subject which I don't want to talk about too much here. I just want to convey actually in my lecture a very simple message. And this very simple message is addressed to academics. And what I'd like to point out is that our direct contributions to society beyond basic research are much more urgently needed than we like normally to acknowledge as scientists. And let's take these contributions which we are supposed to deliver serious enough. That's essentially what I want to say during my lecture and point out that in addition to education and research, we have a third obligation which concerns societal responsibility. And I will speak about that a little bit later. But I just want at the beginning say that you shouldn't let yourself be distracted too much by my own personal opinions, which I'm sure many of you will not share. And my emphasis, however, is not so much on specific opinions, but on our general academic attitude towards the general public and on our wide-ranged responsibility. And I'm certain that this responsibility will remain whether I'm right or wrong on some specific issues. Now, let me first point out a few points about our beloved and highly relevant basic research obligation. And just remind you to one fact which you are probably aware too well already in these days, namely the impact which the double helix had on our entire world. And of course, the UK can be enormously proud of this achievement 50 years ago. But I just want to point out here at this point that without the Swiss it wouldn't have been possible either. Because in 1950, Professor Rudolf Signer from the University of Bern, he actually brought over to this island here a sample of DNA which finally led to the diffraction patterns which Rosalind Franklin was recording. And without this sample, which was extremely pure DNA, these recognitions by Watson and Crick probably wouldn't have taken place. So again, a connection between our two countries. But let me speak very briefly about the subject which I'm mostly have been concerned with during the past 40 or so years. And you know that the atomic nuclei, they have a magnetic moment built in, which is completely irrelevant for any phenomena in physics or in chemistry, but it can be used as a sort of a spy internally built in into our material. So each of these atomic nuclei carries such a magnetic moment. And when we apply an external magnetic field, then these nuclei, they start to precess, and we can measure their precession frequencies, and these precession frequencies tell us something about the molecular environment. And in order to see these very tiny nuclei, we need very large instruments, and this is one of these multi-million pound instruments which is needed to see this very tiny nuclei. And the result are then two-dimensional NMR spectra from which one can finally deduce a molecular structure here of a biomolecule. And that's essentially the reason why Kurt Wüthrich, who will be the next speaker in this series, I think in July, he got his Nobel Prize just last year for the determination of three-dimensional structures of biological macromolecules in solution by means of nuclear magnetic resonance. But of course, one can apply this technique also to larger samples. For example, to humans, one needs even larger, even more expensive magnets. One can feed these people into the magnet and get then insights into their body. And for example, one can here see what has been going wrong with my knee 3 months ago, and where the damaged collateral ligaments here are neatly visible, and it's still not perfect, but it's improving. So it's just, unfortunately, just a diagnostic technique and doesn't improve the healing. And I mean, I mentioned yesterday at the dinner party this internal of my head, which turned out to be so disappointingly normal. And myself, I felt so special when the doctor in charge was coming to me and telling that it was really a great disappointment to me that I'm just normal. But I mean, sometimes it's good to be normal. For example, here. I mean, you see here heads before and after drinking too much alcohol. And especially if you, by nature, have unfortunately the wrong sex, namely being a female, then the damages will be much more pronounced than being a man. So be careful afterwards during the party, especially if you belong to this group, don't drink too much. So that's the kind of information which one can get out of NMR. But I mean, what's even more interesting is functional imaging, where one can see how the brain is really working in action. For example, finger tipping. And seeing where the reaction in the brain occurs allows one to distinguish between paraplegic and healthy person. There is a different signal here which one can interpret and learn something about the functioning of the brain. Or one can here distinguish between schizophrenic and normal people, where there is a particular response here in the brain by a particular visual acoustic paradigm which one applies in order to excite this response. Or, for example, it's interesting to know that when one is growing up in a bilingual environment, then the information of the red and the blue language are stored in the same area of the brain, but if you learn a language later, then you need 2 different areas in the brain, and obviously switching back from this red to the blue language is more difficult for these people than for those. And one can learn about other things that women are using 2 sides of their brain while processing languages, while men rely just on 1 half. You can make your conclusion. And you can also, I mean, if you want to know whether it's worth learning a musical instrument, just make a brain scan and you will find that when you have an asymmetric response here in your brain, then you are probably useful for a musician, otherwise you better don't start. So, and also acupuncture, the question is, these are the vision-related points down here, is the signal transmitted from here to the eyes when one puts in the needle, as you see it here being done. And what has been found out by MRI is that it's actually a 2-step process from the acupoint to the brain and from the brain to the organ, something which we, as scientists, can very easily understand. So, I mean, after all, we certainly agree with George Peck, who said magnetic resonance imaging is an irrefutable testimonial for the enormous value of basic research. So basic research is important, and we can be proud of it, but not too much. Because Lord Bertrand Russell, of course, he was very strongly associated here with LSE. I mean, he says, whereas in art, nothing worth doing can be done without genius, in science, even very modest capacity can contribute to a supreme achievement. So, you see, that's me. But, of course, still, we love research, we love science. I mean, that's what we are living off. But, I mean, we live and we get our income from teaching, which sometimes we are less excited about. But anyway, it's important, you know. And we're also doing it quite well in Switzerland. You see, for example, here's a percentage of foreign students in various OECD countries, and we are far ahead of everybody else. England is not too bad either here. 10% foreigners, while we have 17% foreigners to be educated. But of course, the absolute numbers in England are much larger than what we have here in Switzerland. But you probably also heard from Sir Klaus Moser, who was also associated with this institution here, that education costs a lot of money. But so does ignorance as well. And just in the moment, our parliament is fighting in Switzerland for an increase of support, educational support, yearly by 4 to 6% for about 4 years. So that should be an appreciable increase in our means which we have available for good teaching. But then again, Lord Bertrand Russell. I mean, he tells you that men are born ignorant but and not stupid, and they are made stupid by education. And I mean, to some extent I can understand him. If I watch students during their studies from the first semester to the last one, how their interest is decreasing, how fewer questions they are asking in a lecture room, in these large lecture halls filled with students and just one single teacher. And I'm sure you are doing it much better here in the UK. You do it much more professionally, this education. But we are still using these large lecture rooms for our teaching activities. And of course, especially if these courses are being taught by these science robots, like you see one here. Actually, it's a very cute one. It's made out of chocolate, so it's a typical Swiss science robot. And I'm sure that you don't have them here in England. And anyway, I think that leads us over now to our third obligation. In addition to teaching and to education, and it has to do here with our split world. I mean, we have here our world which we like so much, seen through the microscope with magnetic resonance or whatever, and on the other side, the real world, being squeezed here by our achievements. And we normally care much about this, but little about that part of our world. Now, of course, we have to try to get acquainted with what is happening out here. And if one likes to characterize our world, I mean, it's difficult to do that in a few terms. I came up with these six observations. First of all, our unlimited belief in technological means. Secondly, our unlimited faith in free market economy. Thirdly, natural resources are probably limited, otherwise one wouldn't fight wars. And this increasing gap between rich and poor, I mean, that's just a fact. And on the other side, the loss of an accepted ethical foundation, that's also something which we feel daily, and the governance by a single superpower, I mean, we feel each second. And, I mean, if we want to see how our public actually is performing in the moment, I came up with this little drawing. A plane, a night flight, vol de nuit, and the plane without a reliable pilot flying somewhere with a few alluring stars which never can be reached, and sooner or later we will have a crash landing. And the question is, who is capable of preventing that crash landing? Shall it be politics? Shall it be economy? Shall it be the academic community, hopefully all together? Shall it be the NGOs? I don't want to say too much here about the NGOs because they can't really accept responsibility for what is going on. They can just from time to time remind us what we are doing wrongly. But before I can speak about the obligations of the academic community, we have briefly to look outside and to see what our partners are doing in economy and in politics. And I claim here with this transparency that we cannot expect too much from them in terms of the long-term planning of our future, because who wants to risk his own job? I mean, these guys here, politicians, they have to be re-elected. And The job safety in industry today is enormously low. And for example, these two partners of this broker company, I mean, they just have two possibilities. Either the senior partner jumps first to death or the junior partner. I mean, the company is in such a bad shape. So, I mean, who wants to risk anything else in a situation like that? And academics, we are sitting up here, and who wants to get wet feet? So, I mean, we also are in a little bit dubious situation. So, what state is our world in? Are we today in an economic crisis? Probably we cannot deny it. And too many people are today on the street. And I mean, this advertisement doesn't help them too much. Next time, just take the train and relax in the meantime. That's probably not a good advice to them either. But the only question remains, why do we have an economic crisis today? I don't know. And I just have a few questions here to be asked. Is it just perhaps a coincidence of unfortunate facts which led to this situation? Or is it just a cyclic behavior which we just need patience and stamina to overcome? Or is it, are there perhaps too many regulatory barriers to limit our free market? Or do we have just to expand by all means the coverage of our global market to increase profits? Or has it perhaps something to do with our arrogated privileges, being a small affluent minority which has so far taken more than it deserves? I don't want to give any answers. I think it's just the fact that something is going wrong. And the stock market is going down. A lot of this phony business is going on, various kinds here combined into a single slide of different types which don't have much to do together. But anyway, it's probably not what we would like to see. And I'm sure it's not yet finished. And this fiddling will continue. And just hear these people who paid $1.4 billion to settle their disagreement at Wall Street. I mean, that is not the last word either. And the only curve today which is going uphill is this one. As you know, it probably is slowing down a little bit today. And these are the CEO salaries. And of course, that doesn't look like a healthy situation. And you know that money-mindedness corrupts. And just a small suggestion here, why not pay the CEOs by bonus certificates, which can be spent exclusively for charitable contributions for something? I think that would really improve the situation. And they would get a lot of money, but they would have to invest it properly afterwards. And I can admit at this point that the honorarium for this evening also will go into such a charitable pathway, which I will mention towards the end. And one could, for example, these bonus certificates just slip into this book, which should anyway be on the desk of any CEO, the Ethics for Beginners. And we all depend on our beloved free market economy, whether we are investors and are just in the course of losing our fortune, or whether we are stock analysts who are just in the course of losing our job. We all depend on this beast here. And the beast obviously has been invented by a famous English gentleman, Charles Darwin, with his natural selection, which worked so perfectly for nature. But most likely it is suboptimal for economics. I mean, even for nature, I mean, it worked very well for us, but if we would have, for example, been born into the skin of a dinosaur, I mean, we probably wouldn't have liked this principle so much. And anyway, you know what it stands for maximizing profits, maximizing shareholder value, no ethics, and so on. I don't have to go into these details, which are so well known, but it's clear today that in all fields of human activity, competition has become much more important, much more significant than cooperation. And today, unless we run faster every day, every hour, we will not remain competitive. So we have to speed up in order to remain on the positive side. But why? More research results in lesser time. Why more consumer products, more consumption, and more garbage being produced? And we really don't know what that all is leading to, just to improve our economy. And nobody is asking whether we are running in the proper direction. I mean, just speed alone, that's probably not sufficient. We also have to select the direction into which we want to run and select it properly. And otherwise, this accelerating hectic in our life just leads to increasing superficiality, decreasing feeling of security, a loss of meaning in our own life, to an accelerated decay of culture and to an accelerated destruction of our living grounds. And we are today, so to say, in a speed trap, in an acceleration trap, and can't get out anymore. And then, of course, again, a famous Englishman, he just tells us, rely on my invisible hand, and he is granting us benediction, and it will save all our doing, even if we just look for ourselves. But I have the feeling that in the last 227 years, this invisible hand wasn't too active in a positive way, and I'm not convinced that in the future it will. And wealth of the rich, which creates jobs for the poor, is a nice idea, but it's probably also true that the richer the rich, the more garbage to feed the poor. And I think we are living today on the account of the disfavored. We are living on the account of the third world, and on the future generations. We are using up their resources which they would need to have a decent living later on, and we don't care so much about what they have left. Of course, Adam Smith, he was a moral person. He was writing about benevolence, compassion, sympathy, and love, but I think that he probably overestimated the beneficial qualities of human beings. It's a nice attitude, but I think one has to be more realistic. And I would, for example, recommend once to read this book here by Robert H. Frank on luxury fever, where he tells you where this all leads, that many goods become more attractive to us when others also have them, means that consumption spending has much in common with a contagious illness, and the explosive proliferation of sports utility vehicles in American parking lots is simply unintelligible. And then that leads also to problems in our society and our poor children getting attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, don't have any safe ground anymore on which they can build up their existence. And of course, then a Swiss chemical company produces Ritalin, and the largest community of consumers are in the United States, so that's why it's called the Ritalin Nation. And with that, we can keep it again in bounds, but whether that's the way to do, I have some doubts. And we are really today in an identity crisis, in a crisis of objectives. And we are in need of novel, comprehensive, and lasting approaches which really tell us what to do in the future. So we should come back, I think, to our own senses. We should abandon forced consumption and regain our humanness and discover ourselves, our senses, and the beauty of the world. But of course, then again, Karl Popper, he tells us that the dogma that economic power is at the root of all evil must be discarded. Its place must be taken by an understanding of the dangers of any form of uncontrolled power, and cannot just attribute it to the economic problem. It's a problem which is lying much deeper. And obviously that leads us now directly into politics. And I have to say a few words about politics here. Also, I know that I will have to say some unfriendly words about one of your friends, who is actually not too far from my heart also. But, you know, the other ones which I will not mention are not by any means better. They are just less powerful and therefore potentially less dangerous. And indeed, if you look at the United States, national interests have absolute priority. From banishing the Kyoto Protocol, ABM withdrawal, violating agreements on the reduction of nuclear weapons, blocking anti-landmine conference, rejecting convention on the right of the child, and finally rejecting the International Criminal Court, you can find essentially everything which is against international agreements. And you see this gentleman here in this self-produced smoke of science. And of course, this I mentioned already, and it's very well known. But I mean, we have to remember that international agreements and international organizations are the most invaluable treasures of foresight for the future. That's what we can produce. And all national interests, they should stand back. Otherwise, we cannot hope for a positive development in the future. And what remains? Not much. Just despair and shame. And it really turned out that this prayer here, which he daily was sending out of his window, really turned out true, and fighting the war was really easier than to justify it. But after all, what is important in this kind of politics is justification and not so much justice. Who cares about that? And on the other side, we know it as scientists and as normal citizens, that the very first request is absolute honesty, and falsehood poisons the environment more than anything else, even chemical or biological weapons. And here, I mean, the problems, they start. I don't want to go too much into the details, but I mean, you have heard about this deal of Rumsfeld with Hussein in 83, where already the Bechtel group was involved. Halliburton and Bechtel will remove all the damage now, and everybody else except for the US finally will pay for it. You probably also have read about this statement of principles, which was published in 1997, where already American global leadership is pointed out, increased defense spending, international friendly order, friendly to our security, our prosperity, and our principles. And you see who is signing here this. So we really have to ask, in whom shall we trust? And it's deplorable, not the war by itself so much, but I mean the offense against international law which was committed by those who otherwise claim to enforcing law and to guarantee freedom. But that's just a fact, and the result obviously is also reflected in this public opinion here in England, where the politicians are on the trust scale here at the very, very, very bottom. The business leaders are a little bit higher, not so much, but you know, also ordinary people, they lie 50% of the time. And professors are a little bit better, they say at least 80% of the time they say the truth, and doctors are on top here. So, I mean, still the question remains, who shall provide long-term guidance? Who shall provide guidance so that our boat will not sink? And for me, it's clear. It's the university as a community, academic community, which has to provide a sizable and important share. And we should convert our trade schools, which they are today mostly, again into cultural centers, which have a radiation which goes out into the general public. And, oh, no, that's something wrong. Let's see what happened here. I switched now to the very end of this. No. How can I redo that? Let me see. I want to go to back to the slide which I had before, which was something like numbers. It's about here, 18.9. Okay, thanks very much. I mean, in contrast to people in industry, in politics, we have the freedom to essentially do what we want. And we have granted this academic freedom, and it means then also to do voluntarily what needs to be done. And we have the freedom to speak up and to say what we think. And I'd like to illustrate it by this slide here, our global vehicle, where I think that this vehicle that represents our world, the society, or the passengers on this vehicle, entertained by the politicians, kept in a good mood. And then we have here this very strong drive wheel, the industry, which pushes this vehicle forward, irrespective of the direction, doesn't matter, it just has to go fast. The faster, the better. And I think we also need here a front wheel, a guiding wheel, which determines the direction. I think that's our obligation at universities to determine the direction in which this vehicle has to go. The question is only, are we capable of doing that? And I mean, often I have the feeling that we are more super technicians than wise people who have lost all their wisdom and the foresight to create these guidelines which are so needed for the global development. And here, another little drawing how I see the scientists today. They are sitting down in the shaft and working on the foundations. And whether the world becomes more stable by that or not, that's a different question. They have lost contact here to the green outside, to the sunshine, and are working on here on these basic principles. Of course, these basic principles are enormously important. I'm very sorry, but something is going wrong here. Anyway, this has also been pointed out by Frank H.T. Rhodes, who was the former president of Cornell University. And he once was writing that the sciences have become powerful but increasingly unintelligible to non-scientists. And the social sciences, entranced by microanalysis and quantification, have become increasingly irrelevant to social issues and public policy. And the humanities, embracing fragmentation, otherness, and unreality, have neglected the great overarching issues of human commonality. And also Karl Popper, he says something very similar. I mean, he pointed out that it's important that we educate the population, and that I'm thinking of the obligation of each intellectual to help others for liberating themselves and for developing a critical mind. But unfortunately, the desire to impress and to infatuate instead of instructing is widespread among intellectuals. And as I said, research, basic research, is indispensable. But we have to develop the capability, so to say, to work on two levels, on the blue level and on the yellow level. At the same time, in each individual, we have to work into depth, at the same time keep a wide open mind to see the societal and the global problems and to help to contribute towards the solution of these problems. So to say, we have to think globally and work locally at the same time. And of course, we shouldn't just have specialists with a yellow hat and specialists with a blue hat. They are caring about width and they are caring about depth. That doesn't work. Each scientist, each academic person has to have both hats simultaneously on his head. And I think the rules are very simple. We have to start to dream again and to have visions about the future. And we have to try to imagine an ideal world and work towards this goal as much as we can. And what is most important is that we speak up and express ourselves as freely as we ever can. And I think it's less important to make mistakes than to keep back with one's own opinion. And we as scientists, we are used to commit errors. We always make errors day by day and we correct them, and it's a trial and error procedure how we get to our results. Why not also use it in this context and speak up? I think otherwise we will never reach the goal. And as Karl Popper again said, optimism is our duty, and we are all jointly responsible for what will come. And we have to start to break barriers. First of all, break barriers within our universities, between the scientific disciplines, between the sciences and humanities, and then also between the science and the public, between science and politics and science and industry. For example, in Zurich, we have an institution which is caring for that, where, so to say, an agora is being implemented, where people can sit together, stand together, lie together and speak about relevant problems. Of course, here in England, that's probably less necessary, as those universities which still have this college system, where different disciplines are intermixed, there this happens more or less naturally. But we had to start this Collegium Helveticum, which is responsible for the dialogue between the sciences. Now, what can we do in practice? Of course, a university can only be guided by a proper selection procedure of teaching and research staff. So the appointment of professors, that's the moment when one can influence the future of a university. And so one has tried to appoint professors with a broad scope and with this critical sense for global accountability, in addition to being the best in their scientific field. That's of course indispensable under all circumstances, but one needs more than just scientific excellence. And we should learn to express ourselves in a way which can be understood. Use simple terms, for example, at the beginning, at the end of a lecture, insert a small portion which can be understood by everybody. And I think that clears our own mind and it helps to bridge these gaps between different disciplines. And then we have to start out with interdisciplinary discussion groups, think tanks in seminar weeks, or inviting, for example, profound thinkers and experienced field workers to our institute seminars, where normally only details are being discussed. Why not once invite somebody coming from outside and have a completely different view? I think that would stimulate the atmosphere. Or having interdisciplinary teaching teams, A very simple scheme. Just invite somebody from human sciences in a science lecture and let him sit in the back row and from time to time put up his hand and ask a stupid question. And that can change the climate in science lectures, and suddenly the lecturer recognizes that he didn't explain it in a way which was sufficiently broad-minded. I want briefly to speak about this planning of the long-term development and speak mostly about four goals. First of all, the societal goals, then economic goals, international concerns in the context of globalization, and finally also a few words about scientific goals. So let's go first into these societal goals, and which I like to include also fairness. I mean, to these societal goals belongs ethics. I mean, before we can start out, we need an ethical foundation. I think that's important, and we have to work on that. It also will lead to fairness within our society. It will hopefully lead to fairness between nations. It hopefully will lead to a preservation of cultures and intercultural dialogue. I will briefly mention that just in a second. So, first of all, global ethics. I mean, that I just took that out of the internet. That's one possible approach, commitment to culture, commitment of non-violence, commitment to culture of solidarity, commitment to culture of tolerance, commitment to culture of equal rights. We have to formulate our principles in some way and stick to them. And preservation of culture, I think, is important. We often underestimate the importance of culture and think that innovation, that's all we have to promote. Progress, profit, competitiveness, new gadgets to play with, to increase the sale and the profits. I don't think that's sufficient. Our roots are here in the culture relying. And that's what provides stability. And provides rather insecurity. So these two, the blue and the red domain, they have to be in a balanced development. And what also belongs to it is the intercultural dialogue. And I just wanted to mention here a small example where I'm personally involved and where actually the honorarium of this lecture will go to, where we are teaching Tibetan monks in southern India Western science and trying to gain also something for the Western side. So it's an intercultural dialogue, and I think that's in these days enormously important, not only in this context, but in many others as well. Let me say a few words about economics without being a specialist. Yeah, I'm speaking up. It's more than half. Economic goal, I mean, I just have here a few questions: how free shall be free market, profits versus public goals, profitability in a saturated market, satisfying needs or creating desires. I don't want to give the answers. There are experts here in the public who know much more than me. Here, how I envision our present free market economy with this very strong feedback loop, shareholder value, it's running freely, and I don't think it's the ideal system. I will briefly show you another scheme, a modified one. And I think our task, or the task of economy, is not so much to create desires, but to satisfy needs. And all these super deals which we see in our newspapers, on the TV screen, on our home computer, everywhere, I don't think that leads into the proper direction. And what we need, in essence, is a market economy where this feedback loop still exists, but becomes weaker. But I think what is important is an input here without having any feedback connected to. A foresightful, an ethical input where somebody decides, I want to do it because I think it's necessary to do it, and not asking himself, what do I profit from it? I think that would lead to a much better, safer system, and in this sense, I hope that we can convert our free market economy into a responsible market economy. And perhaps sooner or later the LSE could change its name, for example, from LSE to LSRE, London School of Responsible Economics. Globalization, a very few words. Of course, globalization is inevitable, and supranational structures and international law are important, but I think the reason should be a different one, and it should not be just to satisfy our cravings for global profits. Globalization is necessary because out of global responsibility. I mean, all our doings are today of global nature, and therefore we have to accept this global responsibility. I think that's the kind of terminology which we should use, this kind of thinking. And that's also contained in this writing by James Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, where he says that the developed countries have abundance of pretense of attempting to foster development in the world at large, preferring to substitute the rhetoric of ungoverned markets for the hard work of stabilizing regulation. And he also shows here the increasing inequality, which I don't want to go into. But another book which I like to recommend for reading is by Joseph Stiglitz on globalization and its discontents. And he says in here, we cannot go back on globalization. It is here to stay. The issue is how we can make it to work. And if it is to work, there have to be global institutions to help set the rules. And, of course, Amartya Sen, who also is strongly associated with this institution, who was teaching here for many years, I mean, he says essentially it's the same in these words being reproduced here. But I can't go into too much detail at this point. I just want to remind you that you have to be a little bit careful in the future about GATS and its influence on education. I can't go into the details here, but it's a very critical issue, and we have to be careful that our educational systems are not ruined by this kind of ill-deceived globalization. But that's just a side remark. Of course, then, globalization, we come to the question about the multipolar world versus the unipolar world. And my feeling is that we have to set out for a multipolar world. That's the only chance which we have. I mean, if we want to involve everybody, if we want to have a democratic system on a global scale, then we necessarily will lead to a multipolar world. And I'm sure that we have to go in the direction pointed out on this slide here. You remember that 140 years ago, the Emancipation Proclamation was being set up, and all the slaves have been set free forever. And today, I think there is an urgent need that for ourselves to emancipate as citizens of Europe and as citizens of the globe in order to reduce our dependency on one single power center. And we just can't rely any longer just on this big hole here in our global protection shield. And we have to become self-sustained and to create a unified, non-US counterweight in politics and the economy necessary for a future global equilibrium. I think that's necessary. And the issue here is not so much as pointed out here in Newsweek, the bitter rivalry for old world power. I think it's not the old world power between these two gentlemen which is the problem, but it's the European self-esteem and responsibility which both together have to assume. And we don't have to do it in this primitive way, of course. We can still eat our French fries, we can even smoke our Boston cigars and eat our New York steaks. I mean, it should be a friendly relation, but we have to be independent. And that's one way here, the EU accession treaty, which just took place in Athens a few weeks ago, and Switzerland, the president of Switzerland, was also involved, invited. Unfortunately, he's not one of the members who will join soon, but that's just a sad fact. But again, it seems to be going into the proper direction. And you know that democracy within the states, that's not sufficient. We also need democracy between states, and this necessarily leads to a multipolar system. And so I hope that we all, we two islands and the rest, contribute towards a unified and a strong Europe. I think that's important today for the global equilibrium. I wanted to say something also about scientific goals, but I don't do that here. Of course, our main task is the formation of a responsible and innovative leaders with long-term visions, willing to serve society. That's what we are supposed to do, and we should develop into really pathfinders for society. And I'm sure that when we do our job properly at our universities, we also will get the adequate support from society, monetary support, and the recruitment of motivated students, which is difficult in this moment in sciences, for example, will become easier because the students, the young students, they still have this idealism which some of us already have lost. But you know that future well-being may cause pain today, so maybe we have to suffer in order to have it better in the future. And I hope that we all try to find a personal way out of the present identity crisis that torments scientists, politicians, industrialists, and after all of us as citizens. And perhaps this very last slide I'd like to show here contains some truth which was put forward already 400 years ago by François Rabelais. Science sans conscience n'est que ruine de l'âme. Science without conscience ruins the soul. Of course, also politics and economy without conscience equally ruins the soul. But let us set ourselves as academics a positive example, as teachers of a future generation which hopefully will once do a better job than we have done so far. Thank you for your attention.
I think the ambassador will have a lot to comment on.
Professor Ernst, Lord Layard, Professor Steedman, the weather is beautiful outside. We had a wonderful lecture. We learned a lot. We would like to have a lot of sympathy, your sympathy. So I'm really be very short. I just say thank you to Professor Ernst. It's very handy to have Nobel Prize winners at hand for a Swiss ambassador, for any ambassador, because then you have a fantastic public, people who listen, who are interested. Switzerland is present in the United Kingdom. It's very visible when you look at Wimbledon during the tournament. It's very visible at the City of London. It's visible at the universities. And now it's visible through men, personalities like Professor Ernst. That's why we opened at our embassy, very new, a science and technology department. Ladies and gentlemen, Switzerland is not something new to you. I know I see many familiar faces, but let me tell you one thing. Switzerland always in its history had to export something. We always exported something. First, during centuries, we exported soldiers because we couldn't live on our territory, and the only thing we had to export were soldiers, and they were very much in demand, including in Britain. Then we started to produce goods and services, and we produced and exported goods and services. We still do. Then difficult times came up again, and we started some workplaces, to export some workplaces. And, of course, thanks to our scientists, some technological achievements, some scientific achievements, for example, nanotechnology. It's still very much in demand nowadays in Britain. And where is the link to Mr. Professor Ernst? I could consider that once we export also democracy, not necessarily by force, but in other ways, and we try to do that, in a very moderate and moderate way, not in a way of imposing it, but just explaining how useful it can be. Mr. Professor Ernst, on your curb of trustfulness of the different jobs, I have not seen the lawyers. I have not seen the diplomats either. Since I am both, and one of my jobs is doing politics and following the British policy also during wartime, I must say that I consider that you put these two professions, lawyer and diplomat, very high up, because it's too high on your curb. And, of course, I think that the question what is right and what is wrong, what is legal and what is illegal, is a very difficult question at the final analysis. It is not so easy that when everybody say it's illegal, it is not necessarily illegal. Maybe not justified. And I thank you again for all what you said in this atmosphere of scientific freedom. We like freedom. We all like freedom. And we liked it very much today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Hillary.
Well, like the Ambassador, I will be short, but I must say that I feel very honoured indeed to have been here, to have listened to Professor Ernst's lecture. His scientific achievements are staggering. We all benefit. His work has been of great benefit to society, and now he is putting his talents to work again for society in a different way. I express my admiration and actually my agreement with almost everything he said. Now, I am also struck, though, by the difference between our two societies. In terms of participation in university education, it's perhaps ironic that I've been asked to speak here today, because my main research interest is the 50% of our young people who don't go to university, those who take up apprenticeships and those who go into vocational education of various sorts. Also a great interest of Richard Layard's. But I think I have to say that the expansion of university education in this country, which is far in excess of the expansion in Switzerland, gives a rather different perspective on social responsibility of universities. I feel that perhaps if I could make one remark about Professor Ernst's analysis, I feel we've neglected a bit the absolute good that we are creating by bringing young people into universities, by improving their analytical skills, by giving them the ability to understand their world better, to analyze it more accurately and objectively, and to apply those skills and improve those skills throughout their lives. So when we talk about the responsibilities of universities, personally, I like to think that the responsibility of universities is also to be as all-embracing, as socially inclusive as possible, that we are aiming for 50% of our young people to have some experience of university education. I hope we can go beyond that, that young people who follow an apprenticeship in this country will continue part-time, perhaps, while still working, but will continue and go to university in a particular area which interests them, that they will be entitled to general education, not just to a narrow, narrowly focused vocational education, as is the case now, that this expansion of education, the rise in the average level of understanding and analysis in our population will continue, and that universities will be the main vehicle for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hilary. I think that you should come back here and face the music. Now, who would like to sing first? You.
Thank you. I'm not a singer, sir.
Say who you are, please.
I'm a physician, Karunanithi, from a developing country, which you rightly said, sir. First and foremost is my, what is the speed will recovery for you, Professor Richard Attenborough.
I just want to say one other thing to everybody.
Okay.
We have a very short amount of time. I think sort of 30 seconds per question or comment.
I'm not a lord, okay? I'm not born in this country. My language skill is not that good as you.
Okay, you can have 45.
60 minutes, 60 seconds, sorry, okay? Thank you, because sometimes the British are kind to the Asians as well. Thank you. Yes. First and foremost, my get well speedy recovery for you, sir, as a physician. So it is like more than Richard Attenborough or Richard Branson. Richard Ernst is such a good lecturer, sir. Yeah, as we all know, it is more than spectacular. I mean, SPECT or MRI is good. There are three issues which I wanted to. You mentioned about education, research, and social responsibility. All my questions are around social responsibility. Number one is that how you think is my inability to meddle with the structures of chemistry, I mean, covalent, boron, whatever bond, prevents me from teaching chemistry, biochemistry, or molecular medicine or clinical medicine, because in this country, I can't teach clinical medicine because I lack my basic science, not knowledge, my research capability. If I talk my mind, I need to carry a crutch, not physical one. So how do you think that my inability to learn the basic science research prevents me from teaching clinical medicine? That's also a form of chemistry. Number two is non-profit. In between the small university circle and the big industry circle, there is a non-profit circle which we all want to have. You, the Swiss, have import so much drugs only at an astronomical price. Why don't we have a profit-making industry? Instead of profit-making industry, in the universities, we can have a non-profit industry. And again, your banking. So much of our third world money is in your bank, which we don't want us to use for terror, but to feed our poor, which you highlighted. Other thing is, you mentioned about Amartya Sen. Why is that we the third world? You rightly told about high levels of creativity everywhere. Why is that we are being denied Nobel Prize? I'm sure that there are so many individuals, more than like you, in my country or in Africa, we couldn't do research because you don't allow us to your industry. Finally, rather than exporting, in order to export more from the Swiss, import more talent from the third world. In this country, even to LSE, I need to pay twice to get academic. I know, because they rip us, even now, they rip us. Finally, I agree. I appreciate you, sir, for your entry to United Nations. Let us all strengthen the United Nations so that we will have a multipolar world rather than the British and the American world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you want to reply, or should we have some other questions and then you take them all? Okay. Maybe that's good. Who would like to go next? Maybe you comment on this while people think.
I mean, many points which you made, as far as I could understand them language-wise,
I can write if you want to give a lot of time.
They referred just to the regular obligations of universities, which I didn't touch so much. Of course, I mean, funding and getting contact work with industry or whatever you mentioned in that respect, I have nothing against that, and that's should be going on as it has been going on so far. And I mean, that also refers a little bit to what Dr. Stedman has said before. I mean, she mentioned that I didn't speak so much about educational aspects at universities, and that we shouldn't underestimate what we put, what sort of capital we invest in our students. Of course, I completely agree with that, and that's very important, and that's our major obligation. But I just say that in addition to these obligations, which we always had, there is one more. And I was speaking about this additional obligation, and therefore maybe I have neglected much of what is commonly known as the two main obligations of universities, which I just didn't want to mention, because anyway I was short in time.
Can I ask you, you describe this as an obligation of universities, whereas I think I would rather think of it as an obligation of individual academics, mm-hmm. because I think that it's particularly in social science, it's quite dangerous if the university, as a university,
yeah.
becomes involved, even in organizing what you might call think tank as such. I mean, direct policy proposals, I feel, shouldn't come from university institutions. They should come from, they can come from individual academics, and we all have our obligation to think about policy. I think if we want to participate in structures, at least my view was, and I founded one think tank, that it should be outside the university. It shouldn't be in the university. I'd be interested in your comment on that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, the term university, that wasn't probably a well-chosen term. Of course, all the initiatives have to come from individuals.
Right.
And they have to form these kind of think tanks. But an individual alone cannot do it.
Mm.
And perhaps for this reason I use the term university, because it's something larger which has to develop within the university, of course, based completely on individual initiative, and it shouldn't be the president of the university who set up these councils and these new tanks. But everything in a university should be based on personal initiative. And I think in this sense, we are not too far from each other. Whether it's inside or outside, I mean, I don't care so much. I mean, anyway, we are essentially free to do what we want, and if we set up the tank and use a lecture room within the university for that purpose, or be in a restaurant outside, I mean, that's for me a detail.
Yeah, I wasn't talking physically, but I think that in terms of the formal structure and control, I mean, when you say an individual sets up, does everything in a university, that's true. You set up your laboratory, but the university ratifies the laboratory and ultimately governs the laboratory. Whereas I think that it's quite dangerous if an individual can set up a think tank in a university for which the university appears to be responsible, but is adopting one particular position in a public debate.
I mean, in some sense, it's a university affair, because in the appointment contract, there should be this third point in, that the obligations refer not only to teaching and research, but there is also this additional obligation towards the public education, of the public information, of the public critical views, the planning the future. That should also be in the appointment contract somewhere. It doesn't mean that the university has to organize it, but as a request towards the teachers, that should exist, and they should also be honored for that. I mean, that it's part of their obligations, and time-wise they can invest some of their time for it.
Right. Yes.
My name is Marcus Allen at Nexus Magazine UK. Professor Ernst, I congratulate you on your most excellent presentation. I think you would be remarkably surprised at how many people would totally agree with the ideas you put forward. It is something which bubbles away under the surface. We may have seen a physical expression of it on the streets of London in the anti-war protest, but that was just one particular objective. Not saying that everybody supports that particular view, but the perception is that there is an unfairness in the world. When you look at the big companies, the multinationals, the people who will say themselves that they provide the wealth that people can demonstrate on the streets of London, they will not perceive themselves as being unfair. But from the view from the streets is that they are unfair. How do we get from where we are today, where society is polarizing, to where you would, I hope, expect us to get to, applying fairness as a goal? Academics do great work, but they don't hold the guns. And as Mao Tse-tung said, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. Presidents and prime ministers have the guns. You have the ideas. How do we get from where we are here to where they are today?
I think it's very interesting what you say, that when you say that many people, perhaps even most people, would agree with what I have said. But in some way, I mean, this tells me I could stop giving these kind of lectures. It's general knowledge, but that's not what the fact is. I mean, everybody might agree, but nobody says it. And I think that's the crucial point. We have to speak about it. We have to stand up and express our opinion, and most people don't do that. I mean, in industry, in politics, it's sometimes difficult to do that unless you like to risk your job. But at the university, we can, and we should take that risk. It's a small risk, and we might lose perhaps something somewhere, a grant or some recognition. But we should do that, and I think that's the very first step, and it's the essential step, that we say the truth, what we think is the truth. And even if it might be, after all, wrong, but we have to be open-minded. I think that's the first step, and if we achieve that, we have achieved already quite a lot.
Thank you. Just one comment, if I might make it at this point. In Versailles, on May the 13th, next week, is a meeting attended by, shall we say, the movers and shakers of the world, about 120 of them. It will not be reported in the press, but much of what will be discussed there will be setting the agenda for the future. Why is this not discussed? It's the Bilderberg meeting, by the way.
I can't give you an answer.
Okay. It was a rhetorical question, really.
Last question.
My name is Robin Hannah. I'm born at 67. I graduated many years ago here. I read something which really infuriated me. This today, the Times Higher Educational Supplement, nobody else might have read it, but Charles Clark, the minister, is responsible for higher education. He relates to the sciences and the humanities. He said it's worthless people studying medieval history or classics. And I mean, they didn't mind a few people like that around, but I'm not going to have to stake in pouring any money into these areas of concern. So obviously, maybe God has been the practical thing in science, which you're an expert on, but the humanities are worthless. And I don't know what you might find. I don't know whether anyone else has heard this. It was only the something I read today in the Times Higher Educational Supplement, but it's already been criticized as philistinism.
I think I mentioned that briefly, and preservation of culture on one side and progress on the other side, and one should find a balance between the two. Both are important, and in this respect, humanities are very important to retain our culture. And if we lose our culture, we are lost, even if we have a lot of gadgets which seem to support our life. We need a basis, we need our culture, that's very important.
I'm afraid that's all the time we've got. It seems to me this has been a really interesting and stimulating evening. It's very, very important that academics do try and communicate with the wider public. I mean, I think it's absolutely extraordinary how many of our colleagues here think they're doing something important, but it's not important to tell anybody. In fact, they might even discover whether what they were doing was important if they tried to tell it to somebody other than their little circle. So, I mean, that's the first point. Second, of course, I think it's incredibly important that academics are a source of social criticism. And you put up the cover of Robert Frank's book, which I like very much, Luxury Fever. Actually, Robert Frank wrote almost the same book 20 years before, and he had to write Luxury Fever because nobody took any notice of the one before. This is a fundamental critique of some of the assumptions of economics, which even other critics like Joe Stiglitz, when he wrote the standard text, which Robert Frank was criticizing, took no notice of. So, I mean, it's a really very dangerous situation when somehow these disciplines become so strong. I'm talking more of social science than natural science. They become so strong that they almost are impervious to sideways criticism. And I think you've drawn our attention to the absolutely crucial need for sort of self-criticism and criticism of society by academics. You've done it in a really interesting and stimulating way, and I know we all enjoyed it enormously, and thank you very, very much indeed.